She looked for a moment at the nubs in Beverly's sweatshirt. Her glance was loving but pitiless. I don't know what I'm going to do around here once you're married and have a place of your own.
I'll be around for just about ever, Beverly said, smiling.
Her mother hugged her briefly and kissed the corner of her mouth with her warm, dry lips.
I know better, she said, but I love you, Bevy.
I love you too, Mama.
You make sure there aren't any streaks on those windows when you're done, she said, picking up her purse and going to the door. If there are, you'll catch the blue devil from your father.
I'll be careful.
As her mother opened the door to go out, Beverly asked in a tone she hoped was casual,
Did you see anything funny in the bathroom, Mom?
Elfrida looked back at her, frowning a little.
Funny?
Well, I saw a spider in there last night. It crawled out of the drain. Didn't Daddy tell you?
Did you get your dad angry at you last night, Bevy?
No, uh-uh. I told him a spider crawled out of the drain and scared me, and he said sometimes they used to find drowned rats in the toilets at the old high school. Because of the drains.
He didn't tell you about the spider I saw?
No.
Oh, well, it doesn't matter. I just wondered if you saw it.
I didn't see any spider. I wish we could afford a little new linoleum for that bathroom floor.
She glanced at the sky, which was blue and cloudless.
They say if you kill a spider, it brings rain. You didn't kill it, did you?
No, Beverly said. I didn't kill it.
Her mother looked back at her, her lips pressed together so tightly they almost weren't there.
You sure your dad wasn't angry with you last night?
No.
Bevy, does he ever touch you?
What?
Beverly looked at her mother, totally perplexed.
God, her father touched her every day.
I don't get with you.
Never mind, Elfrida said shortly. Don't forget the trash. And if those windows are streaked, you won't need your father to give you blue devil.
I won't. Does he ever touch you?
Forget. And be in before dark.
I will.
Does he?
Worry an awful lot.
Elfrida left. Beverly went into her room again and watched her around the corner and out of view as she had her father. Then when she was sure her mother was well on her way to the bus stop, Beverly got the floor bucket, the Windex, and some rags from under the sink. She went into the living room and began on the windows. The apartment seemed too quiet. Each time the floor creaked or a door slammed, she jumped a little. When the Boltons' toilet flushed above her, she uttered a gasp that was nearly a scream. And she kept looking toward the closed bathroom door. At last, she walked down there and drew it open again and looked inside. Her mother had cleaned in here this morning, and most of the blood which had pooled under the sink was gone. So was the blood on the sink's rim. But there were still maroon streaks drying in the sink itself, spots and splashes of it on the mirror and on the wallpaper. Beverly looked at her pale reflection and realized with sudden superstitious dread that the blood on the mirror made it seem as if her face was bleeding. She thought again, what am I going to do about this? Have I gone crazy? Am I imagining it? The drain suddenly gave a burping chuckle. Beverly screamed and slammed the door, and 5 minutes later her hands were still trembling so badly that she almost dropped the bottle of Windex as she washed the windows in the living room. 5. It was around 3 o'clock that afternoon, the apartment locked up and the extra key tucked snugly away in the pocket of her jeans, when Beverly Marsh happened to turn up Richard's Alley, a narrow walk-through which connected Main and Center Streets, and came upon Ben Hanscom, Eddie Casbrack, and a boy named Bradley Donovan pitching pennies.
Hi, Bev, Eddie said. You get any nightmares from those movies?
Nope, Beverly said, squatting down to watch the game.
How'd you know about that?
Haystack told me, Eddie said, jerking a thumb at Ben, who was blushing wildly for no good reason Beverly could see.
What movies?
Bradley asked, and now Beverly recognized him. He had come down to the Barrens a week ago with Bill Denbro. They had a speech class together in Bangor. Beverly more or less dismissed him from her mind. If asked, she might have said he seemed somehow less important than Ben and Eddie. Less there.
Couple of creature features, she said to him,
and Duck walked closer until she was between Ben and Eddie.
You pitching?
Yes,
Ben said. He looked at her quickly, then looked away.
Who's winning?
Eddie,
Ben said.
Eddie's real good.
She looked at Eddie, who polished his nails solemnly on the front of his shirt and then giggled.
Can I play?
Okay with me, Eddie said. You got pence?
She felt in her pocket and brought out 3.
Geez, how do you dare to go out of the house with such a wad? Eddie asked. I'd be scared.
Ben and Bradley Donovan laughed.
Girls can be brave, too, Beverly said gravely. and a moment later they were all laughing. Bradley pitched first, then Ben, then Beverly. Because he was winning, Eddie had lasties. They tossed the pennies toward the back wall of the Center Street drugstore. Sometimes they landed short, sometimes they struck and bounced back. At the end of each round, the shooter with the penny closest to the wall collected all four pennies. 5 minutes later, Beverly had 24 cents. She had lost only a single round. "Girl, cheat," Bradley said, disgusted, and got up to go. His good humor was gone, and he looked at Beverly with both anger and humiliation. "Girl, shouldn't be allowed to..." Ben bounced to his feet. It was awesome to watch Ben Hanscom bounce. "Take that back." Bradley looked at Ben, his mouth open. "What?" "Take it back. She didn't cheat." Bradley looked from Ben to Eddie to Beverly, who was still on her knees. Then he looked back at Ben again. "You want a fat lip to math the rest of you, asshole?" "Sure," Ben said, and a grin suddenly crossed his face. Something in its quality caused Bradley to take a surprised, uneasy step backward. Perhaps what he saw in that grin was the simple fact that after tangling with Henry Bowers and coming out ahead not once, but twice, Ben Hanscom was not about to be terrorized by skinny old Bradley Donovan, who had warts all over his hands as well as that cataclysmic lisp.
"Yeah, and then you all gang up on me," Bradley said, taking another step backward.
His voice had picked up an uncertain waver, and tears stood out in his eyes.
"All a bunch of cheaters."
"You just take back what you said about her," Ben said.
"Never mind, Ben," Beverly said. She held out a handful of coppers to Bradley. "Take what's yours. I wasn't playing for keepsies anyway."
Tears of humiliation spilled over Bradley's lower lashes. He struck the pennies from Beverly's hand and ran for the Center Street end of Richard's Alley. The others stood looking at him, open-mouthed. With safety within reach, Bradley turned around and shouted,
"You're just a little biff, that's all. Cheater, cheater. Your mother's a whore."
Beverly gasped. Ben ran up the alley toward Bradley and succeeded in doing no more than tripping over an empty crate and falling down. Bradley was gone, and Ben knew better than to believe he could ever catch him. He turned toward Beverly instead to see if she was all right. The word had shocked him as much as it had her. She saw the concern in his face. She opened her mouth to say she was okay, not to worry. "Sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me." And that odd question her mother had asked,
"Does he ever touch you?" recurred.
Odd question, yes. Simple yet nonsensical, full of somehow ominous undertones, murky as old coffee. Instead of saying that names would never hurt her, she burst into tears. Eddie looked at her uncomfortably, took his aspirator from his pants pocket, and sucked on it. Then he bent down and began picking up the scattered pennies. There was a fussy, careful expression on his face as he did this. Ben moved toward her instinctively, wanting to hug and give comfort, and then stopped. She was too pretty. In the face of that prettiness, he felt helpless.
"Cheer up," he said,
knowing it must sound idiotic, but unable to think of anything more useful. He touched her shoulders lightly. She had put her hands over her face to hide her wet eyes and blotchy cheeks, and then took them away as if she were too hot to touch. He was now blushing so hard he looked apoplectic.
"Cheer up, Beverly."
She lowered her hands and cried out in a shrill, furious voice,
"My mother is not a whore. She's a waitress."
This was greeted by absolute silence. Ben stared at her with his lower jaw sprung ajar. Eddie looked up at her from the cobbled surface of the alley, his hands full of pennies. And suddenly all three of them were laughing hysterically.
"A waitress," Eddie cackled.
He had only the faintest idea of what a whore was, but something about this comparison struck him as delicious just the same.
"Is that what she is?"
"Yes, yes, she is," Beverly gasped, laughing and crying at the same time.
Ben was laughing so hard he couldn't stand up. He sat heavily on a trash can. His bulk drove the lid into the can and spilled him into the alley on his side. Eddie pointed at him and howled with laughter. Beverly helped him to his feet. A window went up above them and a woman yelled,
"You kids get out of there. There's people that have to work the night shift, you know. Get lost."
Without thinking, the three of them linked hands, Beverly in the middle, and ran for Center Street. They were still laughing. 6. They pooled their money and discovered they had 40 cents, enough for 2 ice cream fraps from the drugstore. Because old Mr. Keene was a grouch and wouldn't let kids under 12 eat their stuff at the soda fountain, He claimed the pinball machines in the back room might corrupt them. They took the fraps in two huge waxed containers up to Basie Park and sat on the grass to drink them. Ben had coffee, Eddie strawberry. Beverly sat between the two boys with the straw, sampling each in turn like a bee at flowers. She felt okay again for the first time since the drain had coughed up its gout of blood the night before, washed out and emotionally exhausted, but okay, at peace with herself. For the time being, anyway.
I just don't get what was wrong with Bradley, Eddie said at last.
It had the tone of an awkward apology.
He never acted like that before.
You stood up for me, Beverly said, and suddenly kissed Ben on one cheek.
Thank you.
Ben went scarlet again.
You weren't cheating, he mumbled, and abruptly gulped down half of his coffee frap and three monster swallows.
This was followed by a burp as loud as a shotgun blast.
Get any on you, Daddy-O?
Eddie asked, and Beverly laughed helplessly, holding her stomach.
No more, she giggled. My stomach hurts. Please, no more.
Ben was smiling. That night, before sleep, he would play the moment when she had kissed him over and over again in his mind.
Are you really okay now? He asked.
She nodded.
It wasn't him. It really wasn't even what he said about my mother. It was something that happened last night.
She hesitated, looking from Ben to Eddie and back to Ben again.
I have to tell somebody, or show somebody, or something. I guess I cried because I've been scared I'm going Looney Tunes.
What are you talking about, Looney Tunes? A new voice asked. It was Stanley Uris. As always, he looked small, slim, and preternaturally neat. Much too neat for a kid who was just barely 11. In his white shirt, neatly tucked into his fresh jeans all the way around, his hair combed, the toes of his high-top Keds spotlessly clean, he looked instead like the world's smallest adult. Then he smiled, and the illusion was broken.
She won't say whatever she was going to say, Eddie thought, because he wasn't there when Bradley called her mother that name.
But after a moment's hesitation, Beverly did tell, because somehow Stanley was different from Bradley. He was there in a way Bradley had not been.
Stanley's one of us, Beverly thought,
and wondered why that should cause her arms to suddenly break out in bumps.
I'm not doing any of them any favors by telling, she thought. Not them, and not me neither.
But it was too late. She was already speaking. Stan sat down with them, his face still and grave. Eddie offered him the last of the strawberry frap, and Stan only shook his head, his eyes never leaving Beverly's face. None of the boys spoke. She told them about the voices, about recognizing Ronnie Grogan's voice. She knew Ronnie was dead, but it was her voice all the same. She told them about the blood and how her father had not seen it or felt it, and how her mother had not seen it this morning. When she finished, she looked around at their faces, afraid of what she might see there. But she saw no disbelief. Terror, but no disbelief. Finally, Ben said, "Let's go look." 7. They went in by the back door, not just because that was the lock Bev's key fitted, but because she said her father would kill her if Mrs. Bolton saw her going into the apartment with three boys while her folks were gone.
Why? Eddie asked. You wouldn't understand, numbnuts, Stan said. Just be quiet.
Eddie started to reply, looked again at Stan's white, strained face, and decided to keep his mouth shut. The door gave on the kitchen, which was full of late afternoon sun and summer silence. The breakfast dishes sparkled in the drainer. The four of them stood by the kitchen table, bunched up, and when a door slammed upstairs, they all jumped and then laughed nervously.
Where is it? Ben asked.
He was whispering. Her heart thudding in her temples, Beverly led them down the little hall with her parents' bedroom on one side and the closed bathroom door at the end. She pulled it open, stepped quickly inside, and pulled the chain over the sink. Then she stepped back between Ben and Eddie again. The blood had dried to maroon smears on the mirror and the basin and the wallpaper. She looked at the blood because it was suddenly easier to look at that than at them. In a small voice she could hardly recognize as her own, she asked,
"Do you see it? Do any of you see it? Is it there?"
Ben stepped forward, and she was again struck by how delicately he moved for such a fat boy. He touched one of the smears of blood, then a second, then a long drip on the mirror. "Here, here, here." His voice was flat and authoritative.
"Jeepers! It looks like somebody killed a pig in here," Stan said, softly awed. "It all came out of the drain?" Eddie asked.
The sight of the blood made him feel ill. His breath was shortening. He clutched at his aspirator. Beverly had to struggle to keep from bursting into fresh tears. She didn't want to do that. She was afraid if she did, they would dismiss her as just another girl. But she had to clutch for the doorknob as relief washed through her in a wave of frightening strength. Until that moment, she hadn't realized how sure she was that she was going crazy, having hallucinations, something.
"And your mom and dad never saw it?" Ben marveled.
He touched a splotch of blood which had dried on the basin and then pulled his hand away and wiped it on the tail of his shirt.
"Jeepers creepers. I don't know how I can ever come in here again," Beverly said. "Not to wash up or brush my teeth or, you know."
"Well, why don't we clean the place up?" Stanley asked suddenly. Beverly looked at him.
"Clean it?
Sure. Maybe we couldn't get all of it off the wallpaper. It looks sort of, you know, on its last legs. But we could get the rest. Haven't you got some rags?"
"Under the kitchen sink," Beverly said.
"But my mom will wonder where they went if we use them."
"I've got 50 cents, Stan said quietly.
His eyes never left the blood that had spattered the area of the bathroom around the wash basin.
"We'll clean up as good as we can, then take the rags down to that coin-op laundry place back the way we came. We'll wash them and dry them, and they'll all be back under the sink before your folks get home."
"My mother says you can't get blood out of cloth," Eddie objected.
"She says it sets in or something."
Ben uttered a hysterical little giggle.
"Doesn't matter if it comes out of the rags or not," he said. "They can't see it."
No one had to ask him who he meant by they.
"All right," Beverly said. "Let's try it."
8. For the next half hour, the four of them cleaned like grim elves, and as the blood disappeared from the walls and the mirror and the porcelain basin, Beverly felt her heart grow lighter and lighter. Ben and Eddie did the sink and mirror while she scrubbed the floor. Stan worked on the wallpaper with studious care, using a rag that was almost dry. In the end, they got almost all of it. Ben finished by removing the light bulb over the sink and replacing it with one from a box of bulbs in the pantry. There were plenty. Elfrida Marsh had bought a 2-year supply from the Dairy Lions during their annual light bulb sale the fall before. They used Elfrida's floor bucket, her Ajax, and plenty of hot water. They dumped the water frequently because none of them liked to have their hands in it once it had turned pink. At last, Stanley backed away, looked at the bathroom with the critical eye of a boy in whom neatness and order are not simply ingrained, but actually innate, and told them, "It's the best we can do, I think." There were still faint traces of blood on the wallpaper to the left of the sink, where the paper was so thin and ragged that Stanley had dared do no more than blot it gently. Yet, even here, the blood had been sapped of its former ominous strength. It was little more than a meaningless pastel smear.
"Thank you," Beverly said to all of them.
She could not remember ever having meant thanks so deeply.
"Thank you all."
"It's okay," Ben mumbled. He was, of course, blushing again.
"Sure," Eddie agreed.
"Let's get these rags done," Stanley said. His face was set, almost stern, and later Beverly would think that perhaps only Stan realized that they had taken another step towards some unthinkable confrontation. 9. They measured out a cup of Mrs. Marsh's Tide and put it in an empty mayonnaise jar. Bev found a paper shopping bag to put the bloody rags in, and the four of them went down to the clean clothes washateria on the corner of Main and Coney Streets. 2 blocks farther up, they could see the canal gleaming a bright blue in the afternoon sun. The clean clothes was empty except for a woman in a white nurse's uniform who was waiting for her dryer to stop. She glanced at the four kids distrustfully and then went back to her paperback of Peyton Place.
"Cold water," Ben said in a low voice. "My mom says you gotta wash blood in cold water."
They dumped the rags into the washer while Stan changed his 2 quarters for 4 dimes and 2 nickels. He came back and watched as Bev dumped the Tide over the rags and swung the washer's door closed. Then he plugged 2 dimes into the coin-op slot and twisted the start knob. Beverly had chipped in most of the pennies she had won at pitch for the fraps, but she found 4 survivors deep down in the left-hand pocket of her jeans. She fished them out and offered them to Stan, who looked pained.
"Geez," he said, "I take a girl on a laundry date and right away she wants to go Dutch."
Beverly laughed a little.
"You sure?"
"I'm sure," Stan said in his dry way.
"I mean, it's really breaking my heart to give up those 4 pence, Beverly, but I'm sure."
The four of them went over to the line of plastic contour chairs against the washateria's cinder block wall and sat there, not talking. The Maytag, with the rags in it, chugged and sloshed. Fans of suds slobbered against the thick glass of its round porthole. At first, the suds were reddish. Looking at them made Bev feel a little sick, but she found it was hard to look away. The bloody foam had a gruesome sort of fascination. The lady in the nurse's uniform glanced at them more and more over the top of her book. She had perhaps been afraid they would be rowdy. Now their very silence seemed to unnerve her. When her dryer stopped, she took her clothes out, folded them, put them into a blue plastic laundry bag, and left, giving them one last puzzled look as she went out the door. As soon as she was gone, Ben said abruptly, almost harshly, "You're not alone."
"What?"
Beverly asked. "You're not alone," Ben repeated. "You see..." He stopped and looked at Eddie, who nodded. He looked at Stan, who looked unhappy, but who, after a moment, shrugged and also nodded.
"What in the world are you talking about?" Beverly asked.
She was tired of people saying inexplicable things to her today. She gripped Ben's lower arm.
"If you know something about this, tell me."
"Do you want to do it?" Ben asked Eddie.
Eddie shook his head. He took his aspirator out of his pocket and sucked in on it with a monstrous gasp. Speaking slowly, picking his words, Ben told Beverly how he had happened to meet Bill Denbro and Eddie Casbrack in the Barrens on the day school let out. That was almost a week ago, as hard as that was to believe. He told her about how they had built the dam in the Barrens the following day. He told Bill's story of how the school photograph of his dead brother had turned its head and winked. He told his own story of the mummy who had walked on the icy canal in the dead heart of winter with balloons that floated against the wind. Beverly listened to all this with growing horror. She could feel her eyes widening, her hands and feet growing cold. Ben stopped and looked at Eddie. Eddie took another wheezing pull on his aspirator and then told the story of the leper again, speaking as rapidly as Ben had slowly, his words tumbling over one another in their urgency to escape and be gone. He finished with a sucking little half-sob, but this time he didn't cry.
"And you?" she asked, looking at Stan Uris.
"I..."
There was sudden silence, making them all start the way a sudden explosion might have done.
"The wash is done," Stan said.
They watched him get up, small, economical, graceful, and open the washer. He pulled out the rags, which were stuck together in a clump, and examined them.
"There's a little stain left," he said, "but it's not too bad. Looks like it could be cranberry juice."
He showed them, and they all nodded gravely, as if over important documents. Beverly felt a relief that was similar to the relief she had felt when the bathroom was clean again. She could stand the faded pastel smear on the peeling wallpaper in there, and she could stand the faint reddish stain on her mother's cleaning rags. They had done something about it. That seemed to be the important thing. Maybe it hadn't worked completely, but she discovered it had worked well enough to give her heart peace. And, brother, that was good enough for Al Marsh's daughter, Beverly. Stan tossed them into one of the barrel-shaped dryers and put in two nickels. The dryer started to turn, and Stan came back and took his seat between Eddie and Ben. For a moment, the four of them sat silent again, watching the rags turn and fall, turn and fall. The drone of the gas-fired dryer was soothing, almost soporific. A woman passed by the chocked open door, wheeling a cart of groceries. She glanced in at them and passed on.
"I did see something," Stan said suddenly. "I didn't want to talk about it, because I wanted to think it was a dream or something. Maybe even a fit, like that Stavier kid has. Any of you guys know that kid?"
Ben and Bev shook their heads. Eddie said, "The kid who's got epilepsy?"
"Yeah, right. That's how bad it was. I would have rather thought I had something like that than that I saw something really real."
"What was it?"
Bev asked. But she wasn't sure she really wanted to know. This was not like listening to ghost stories around a campfire while you ate wieners and toasted buns and cooked marshmallows over the flames until they were black and crinkly. Here they sat in this stifling laundromat, and she could see great big dust kitties under the washing machines, ghost turds, her father called them. She could see dust motes dancing in the hot shafts of sunlight which fell through the laundromat's dirty plate glass window. She could see old magazines with their covers torn off. These were all normal things, nice and normal and boring. But she was scared, terribly scared, because she sensed none of these things were made-up stories, made-up monsters. Ben's mummy, Eddie's leper. Either or both of them might be out tonight when the sun went down. or Bill Denbrough's brother, one-armed and implacable, cruising through the black drains under the city with silver coins for eyes. Yet when Stan did not answer immediately, she asked again, "What was it?" Speaking carefully, Stan said, "I was over in that little park where the standpipe is." "Oh, God, I don't like that place," Eddie said dolefully. "If there's a haunted house in Derry, that's it." "What?" Stan said sharply. "What did you say?" "Don't you know about that place?" Eddie asked. "My mom wouldn't let me go near there even before the kids started getting killed. She takes real good care of me." He offered them an uneasy grin and held his aspirator tighter in his lap. "You see, some kids have been drowned in there, 3 or 4. They..." "Stan? Stan, are you all right?" Stan Urus's face had gone a leaden gray. His mouth worked soundlessly. His eyes rolled up until the others could only see the bottommost curves of his irises. One hand clutched weakly at empty air and then fell against his thigh. Eddie did the only thing he could think of. He leaned over, put one thin arm around Stan's slumping shoulders, jammed his aspirator into Stan's mouth, and triggered off a big blast. Stan began to cough and choke and gag. He sat up straight, his eyes back in focus again. He coughed into his cupped hands. At last he uttered a huge burping gasp and slumped back against his chair.
"What was that?"
he managed at last.
"My asthma medicine," Eddie said apologetically. "God, it tastes like dead dog shit."
They all laughed at this, but it was nervous laughter. The others were looking nervously at Stan. Thin color now burned in his cheeks.
"It's pretty bad, all right," Eddie said with some pride.
"Yeah, but is it kosher?" Stan said, and they all laughed again, although none of them, including Stan, really knew what kosher meant. Stan stopped laughing first and looked at Eddie intently.
"Tell me what you know about the standpipe," he said.
Eddie started, but both Ben and Beverly also contributed. The Derry standpipe stood on Kansas Street, about a mile and a half west of downtown, near the southern edge of the Barrens. At one time, near the end of the previous century, it had supplied all of Derry's water, holding 1.75 million gallons. Because the circular open-air gallery just below the standpipe's roof offered a spectacular view of the town and the surrounding countryside, it had been a popular place until 1930 or so. Families would come out to Tiny Memorial Park on a Saturday or Sunday forenoon when the weather was fine, climb the 160 stairs inside the standpipe to the gallery, and take in the view. More often than not, they spread and ate a picnic lunch while they did so. The stairs were between the standpipe's outside, which was shingled a blinding white, and its inner sleeve, a great stainless steel cylinder standing 106 feet high. These stairs wound to the top in a narrow spiral. Just below the gallery level, a thick wooden door in the standpipe's inner jacket gave on a platform over the water itself. A black, gently lapping tarn lit by naked magnesium bulbs screwed into reflective tin hoods. The water was exactly 100 feet deep when the supply was all the way up.
"Where did the water come from?" Ben asked.
Bev, Eddie, and Stan looked at each other. None of them knew.
"Well, what about the kids that drowned then?"
They were only a bit clearer on that. It seemed that in those days, olden days, Ben called them solemnly, as he took up this part of the tale, the door leading to the platform over the water had always been left unlocked. One night, a couple of kids, or maybe just one, or as many as 3, had found the ground-level door also unlocked. They had gone up on a dare. They found their way out onto the platform over the water instead of onto the gallery by mistake. In the darkness, they had fallen over the edge before they quite knew where they were.
"I heard it from this kid, Vic Crumley, who said he heard it from his dad," Beverly said, "so maybe it's true. Vic said his dad said that once they fell into the water, they were as good as dead, because there was nothing to hold on to. The platform was just out of reach. He said they paddled around in there, yelling for help all night long, probably. Only no one heard them, and they just got tireder and tireder until..."
She trailed off, feeling the horror of it sink into her. She could see those boys in her mind's eye, real or made up, paddling around like drenched puppies, going under, coming up sputtering, splashing more and swimming less as panic set in. Soggy sneakers treading water, fingers scrabbling uselessly for any kind of purchase on the smooth steel walls of the sleeve. She could taste the water they must have swallowed. She could hear the flat, echoing quality of their cries. How long? 15 minutes? Half an hour? How long before the cries had ceased and they had simply floated face down? Strange fish for the caretaker to find the next morning.
God, Stan said dryly.
I heard there was a woman who lost her baby, too, Eddie said suddenly. That was when they closed the place for good. At least that's what I heard. They did used to let people go up, I know that. But then one time there was this lady and her baby. I don't know how old the baby was, but this platform, it's supposed to go right out over the water. And the lady went to the railing and she was, you know, holding the baby, and either she dropped it or maybe it just wriggled. I heard this guy tried to save it, doing the hero bit, you know. He jumped right in, but the baby was gone. Maybe he was wearing a jacket or something. When your clothes get wet, they drag you down.
Eddie abruptly put his hand into his pocket and brought out a small brown glass bottle. He opened it, took out two white pills, and swallowed them dry.
What were those? Beverly asked.
Aspirin. I've got a headache.
He looked at her defensively, but Beverly said nothing more.
Ben finished. After the incident of the baby, he himself, he said, had heard that it was actually a kid, a little girl of about 3. The town council had voted to lock the standpipe, both downstairs and up, and stop the day trips and picnics on the gallery. It had remained locked from then until now. Oh, the caretaker came and went, and the maintenance men once in a while, and once every season there were guided tours. Interested citizens could follow a lady from the Historical Society up the spiral of stairs to the gallery at the top, where they could ooh and ah over the view and snap Kodaks to show their friends. But the door to the inner sleeve was always locked now.
Is it still full of water? Stan asked.
I guess so, Ben said. I've seen fire trucks filling up there during grass fire season. They hook a hose to the pipe at the bottom.
Stanley was looking at the dryer again, watching the rags go around and around. The clump had broken up now, and some of them floated like parachutes.
What did you see there? Bev asked him gently.
For a moment, it seemed he would not answer at all. Then he drew a deep, shuddering breath and said something that at first struck them all as being far from the point.
They named it Memorial Park after the 23rd Maine in the Civil War. The Derry Blues, they were called. There used to be a statue, but it blew down during a storm in the 40s. They didn't have money enough to fix the statue, so they put in a birdbath instead, a big stone birdbath.
They were all looking at him. Stan swallowed. There was an audible click in his throat.
I watch birds, you see. I have an album, a pair of Zeiss Icon binoculars, and everything.
He looked at Eddie. Do you have any more aspirins?
Eddie handed him the bottle. Stan took two, hesitated, then took another. He gave the bottle back and swallowed the pills one after another, grimacing. Then he went on with his story.
10.
Stan's encounter had happened on a rainy April evening 2 months ago. He had donned his slicker, put his bird book and his binoculars in a waterproof sack with a drawstring at the top, and set out for Memorial Park. He and his father usually went out together, but his father had had to work over that night and had called specially at supper time to talk to Stan. One of his customers at the agency, another bird watcher, had spotted what he believed to be a male cardinal, Fringillidae richmondina, drinking from the bird bath in Memorial Park, he told Stan. They like to eat, drink, and bathe right around dusk. It was very rare to spot a cardinal this far north of Massachusetts. Would Stan like to go down there and see if he could collect it? He knew the weather was pretty foul, but Stan had been agreeable. His mother made him promise to keep the hood of his slicker up, but Stan would have done that anyway. He was a fastidious boy. There were never any fights about getting him to wear his rubbers or his snow pants in the winter. He walked the mile and a half to Memorial Park in a rain so fine and hesitant that it really wasn't even a drizzle. It was more like a constant hanging mist. The air was muted, but somehow exciting just the same. In spite of the last dwindling piles of snow under bushes and in groves of trees, to Stan they looked like piles of dirty cast-off pillowcases, there was a smell of new growth in the air. Looking at the branches of elms and maples and oaks against the lead-white sky, Stan thought that their silhouettes looked mysteriously thicker. They would burst open in a week or two, unrolling leaves of a delicate, almost transparent green.
The air smells green tonight, he thought, and smiled a little.
He walked quickly because the light would be gone in an hour or even less. He was as fastidious about his sightings as he was about his dress and study habits,
and unless there was enough light left for him to be absolutely sure, he would not allow himself to collect the cardinal, even if he knew in his heart he had really seen it. He cut across Memorial Park on a diagonal. The standpipe was a white, bulking shape to his left. Stan barely glanced at it. He had no interest whatsoever in the standpipe. Memorial Park was a rough rectangle which sloped downhill. The grass, white and dead at this time of year, was kept neatly cut in the summertime, and there were circular beds of flowers. There was no playground equipment, however. This was considered a grown-up's park. At the far end, the grade smoothed out before dropping abruptly down to Kansas Street and the barrens beyond. The bird bath his father had mentioned stood on this flat area. It was a shallow stone dish set into a squat masonry pedestal that was really much too big for the humble function it fulfilled. Stan's father had told him that, before the money ran out, they had intended to put the statue of the soldier back up here again.
"I like the bird bath better, Daddy," Stan said.
Mr. Uris ruffled his hair.
"Me too, son," he said. "More baths and less bullets. That's my motto."
At the top of this pedestal, a motto had been carved in the stone. Stanley read it, but did not understand it. The only Latin he understood was the genus classifications of the birds in his book. "Operabat idolon senex, Pliny," the inscription read. Stan sat down on a bench, took his bird album out of the bag, and turned over to the picture of the cardinal one more time, going over it, familiarizing himself with the recognizable points. A male cardinal would be hard to mistake for something else. It was as red as a fire engine, if not so large. But Stan was a creature of habit and convention. These things comforted him and reinforced his sense of place and belonging in the world. So he gave the picture a good 3-minute study before closing the book. The moisture in the air was making the corners of the pages turn up, and putting it back into the bag. He uncased his binoculars and put them to his eyes. There was no need to adjust the field of focus, because the last time he had used the glasses, he had been sitting on this same bench and looking at that same birdbath. Fastidious boy, patient boy. He did not fidget. He did not get up and walk around or swing the binoculars here and there to see what else there might be to be seen. He sat still, field glasses trained on the birdbath, and the mist collected in fat drops on his yellow slicker. He was not bored. He was looking down into the equivalent of an avian convention site. 4 brown sparrows sat there for a while, dipping into the water with their beaks, flicking droplets casually back over their shoulders and onto their backs. Then a blue jay came hauling in like a cop breaking up a gaggle of loiterers. The jay was as big as a house in Stan's glasses, his quarrelsome cries absurdly thin by comparison. After you looked through the binoculars steadily for a while, the magnified birds you saw began to seem not odd but perfectly correct. The sparrows flew off. The jay, now in charge, strutted, bathed, grew bored, departed. The sparrows returned, then flew off again as a pair of robins cruised in to bathe and, perhaps, to discuss matters of importance to the hollow-boned set. Stan's father had laughed at Stan's hesitant suggestion that maybe birds talked, and he was sure his dad was right when he said birds weren't smart enough to talk, that their brain pans were too small, but by gosh, they sure looked like they were talking. A new bird joined them. It was red. Stan hastily adjusted the field of focus on the binoculars a bit. Was it? No. It was a scarlet tanager, a good bird, but not the cardinal he was looking for. It was joined by a flicker that was a frequent visitor to the Memorial Park bird bath. Stan recognized him by the tattered right wing. As always, he speculated on how that might have happened. A close call with some cat seemed the most likely explanation. Other birds came and went. Stan saw a grackle, as clumsy and ugly as a flying boxcar, a bluebird, another flicker. He was finally rewarded by a new bird, not the cardinal, but a cowbird that looked vast and stupid in the eyepieces of the binoculars. He dropped them against his chest and fumbled the bird book out of the bag again, hoping that the cowbird wouldn't fly away before he could confirm the sighting. He would have something to take home to his father, at least. And it was time to go. The light was fading fast. He felt cold and damp. He checked the book, then looked through the glasses again. It was still there, not bathing, but only standing on the rim of the bird bath, looking dumb. It was almost surely a cowbird, with no distinctive markings, at least none he could pick up at this distance, and in the fading light it was hard to be 100% sure, but maybe he had just enough time and light for one more check. He looked at the picture in the book, studying it with a fierce frown of concentration, and then picked up the glasses again. He had only fixed them on the birdbath when a hollow rolling boom set the cowbird, if it had been a cowbird, winging. Stan tried to follow it with the glasses, knowing how slim his chances were of picking it up again. He lost it and made a hissing sound of disgust between his teeth. Well, if it had come once, it would perhaps come again. And it had only been a cowbird. Probably a cowbird. After all, not a golden eagle or a great auk. Stan recased his binoculars and put away his bird album. Then he got up and looked around to see if he could tell what had been responsible for that sudden loud noise. It hadn't sounded like a gun or a car backfire. More like a door being thrown open in a spooky movie about castles and dungeons, complete with hokey echo effects. He could see nothing. He got up and started toward the slope down to Kansas Street. The standpipe was now on his right, a chalky white cylinder, phantom-like in the mist and the growing darkness. It seemed almost to float. That was an odd thought. He supposed it must have come from his own head. Where else could a thought come from? But it somehow did not seem like his own thought at all. He looked at the standpipe more closely, and then veered in that direction without even thinking about it. Windows circled the building at intervals, rising around it in a spiral that made Stan think of the barber pole in front of Mr. Orlett's shop, where he and his dad got their haircuts. The bone-white shingles bulged out over each of those dark windows like brows over eyes. Wonder how they did that, Stan thought. Not with as much interest as Ben Hanscom would have felt, but with some, and that was when he saw there was a much larger space of darkness at the foot of the standpipe, a clear oblong in the circular base. He stopped, frowning, thinking that was a funny place for a window. It was completely out of symmetry with the others. Then he realized it wasn't a window. It was a door. The noise I heard, he thought. It was that door blowing open. He looked around. Early, gloomy dusk. White sky now fading to a dull, dusky purple, mist thickening a bit more toward the steady rain which would fall most of the night. Dusk and mist and no wind at all. So, if it hadn't blown open, had someone pushed it open? Why? And it looked like an awfully heavy door to slam open hard enough to make a noise like that boom. He supposed a very big person, maybe. Curious, Stan walked over for a closer look. The door was bigger than he had first supposed. 6 feet high and 2 feet thick, the boards which composed it bound with brass strips. Stan swung it half closed. It moved smoothly and easily on its hinges in spite of its size. It also moved silently. There was not a single squeak. He had moved it to see how much damage it had done to the shingles, blasting open like that. There was no damage at all, not so much as a single mark. Weirdsville, as Richie would say. Well, it wasn't the door you heard, that's all, he thought. Maybe a jet from Loring boomed over Derry or something. Door was probably open all. His foot struck something. Stan looked down and saw it was a padlock. Correction, it was the remains of a padlock. It had been burst wide open. End of side 11.